more than an austerity, an extension of the austerity regime, coupled with some sort of non-binding commitment to have a chat about debt relief at some stage, that I have to say would amount to a very clear betrayal of the will of the Greek people. And when this initially happened, when Tsipras convened a meeting of other party leaders, the mainstream press interpreted this as an attempt on his part to shield himself from regime change. The thought seemed to be that if he had the leaders of those parties that I mentioned standing side by side with him, that there would be no effective means by which he could be deposed by the creditors. I think now, in retrospect, the more likely or plausible explanation is that by entering into a loose and even a fragile alliance with these parties, what Tsipras is aiming to do and what he may accomplish at the end of the day is to isolate the left wing of Syriza, which will have nothing to do with further austerity and will be insistent upon meaningful debt relief. Because if he can rely upon the support of those parties to in respect of any deal that he happens to strike with the Troika between now and the weekend, then he doesn't need the support of his leftist wing. Regrettably, that seems to be where we're heading. The big wild card, I have to say, is going to be how Greeks will respond to this. They were threatened with all manner of devastation and destruction in the lead-up to the referendum, and to their credit, I mean, this is really a victory of the Greek people. It's not a victory of Alexis Tsipras. It's not the victory of any political party in Greece. It's the victory of the Greek people. They stood up to those threats. They resoundingly said no. And if they do what Angela Merkel is now demanding, which is that they accept terms that are even harsher, austerity terms that are even harsher than those that were rejected by the Greek electorate, I think there's a big question about how much patience the Greek people are going to show for that.
So what's really at stake here? What is Syriza trying to prevent here being forced out of the Eurozone, obviously? But what does this mean in terms of their leadership, credibility, and ability to govern there?
Well, I think after having called that referendum, I mean, there was a report by Ambrose Evans-Pritchard of the Telegraph in the UK that Tsipras was depressed on the day after the referendum because he had expected to lose and, in fact, wanted to lose. And this had placed him in a bind. He wanted to have a democratic mandate to enter into an agreement for further austerity and arguably even harsher austerity than anything Greece has had to endure thus far. So I think his credibility at this stage is really hanging by a thread, and I'm hopeful that he will summon the courage to stand up to the Troika, but that will mean, at this stage, it appears, an exit from the Eurozone. The reports are that 15 out of 18 governments support in the European Union currently support in some form Greece's exit from the Eurozone. They seem prepared, at least some of them, to have a discussion about doing that in an orderly manner, in a minimally humane manner. But there is very little appetite amongst the EU governments for Greece's continued participation in the euro. And as I've said many times, this is an extraordinarily complicated and challenging task to transition to another currency. It's something that he has to be preparing for. The entire leadership of Syriza has to be mobilized for this eventuality. Rather than do that, Alexis Tsipras today went to Strasbourg and the European Parliament and, engaged in a fairly unseemly bout of mudslinging with some of the neoliberal leaders within Parliament, including Manfred Weber, a German politician who leads the neoliberal European People's Party. And he was essentially admonishing Tsipras to disavow critical statements that ex-finance minister Varoufakis had made about Eurozone leaders, in particular his claim that they were terrorists. Gus Guy Verhofstadt of the Liberal Bloc, another neoliberal party within Europe, condemned Tsipras's approach to the crisis and said, you know, it's time for him to prove himself to be a true reformer. And of course, in the language of European neoliberalism, reform means vicious austerity. This is what happened today. He spent an entire day basically being tongue-lashed by people who, in normal circumstances, should be showing a great deal of respect to the prime minister of a sovereign state within the Eurozone. But they were treating him like a schoolboy. And this is not what he should have been doing today, frankly. He should have been with his closest advisors and his cabinet preparing for the eventuality of a Grexit, because it appears very much that the political will within the leadership of the Eurozone at this moment is to push Greece out.
And if Greece is kicked out, Alexis Tsipras is in a situation of not being able to manage the situation at home, because he's not actually preparing for what a default might look like at home.
That does appear to be the case, regrettably. I think the writing is on the wall. Everybody who, you know, is a keen observer of the situation, I mean, you can see bank analysts are now saying it, and they're loath to say this sort of thing, that a Grexit seems likely. You know, as I said, 15 out of 18 EU governments in some form seem to support a Grexit. So the likelihood at this stage is, in fact, a Grexit, whatever the leadership of Syriza may or may not want. So that is something that requires intensive preparation. And they seem to be clinging, even to this very day, to the delusion that Greece's continued membership in the Eurozone is both practicable and in the best interest of the country on a long-term basis.
And my last question to you, Dimitri, is there another example we can look at, a country that has defaulted and managed to survive, that could be useful in this case?
Well, certainly the one that often comes to mind is Argentina. Argentina defaulted on its debt abandoned its peg to the U.S. dollar. It effectively was using the U.S. dollar as its currency in 2001 or thereabouts. And there was very significant social unrest and economic hardship for a period of time suffered by the people of Argentina. But in the years following that transition, Argentina experienced very considerable growth. In fact, I believe it was in terms of economic growth for a number of years following the default, it was the leader within South America during a time in which there was quite impressive growth amongst other South American states. Now, that's not to say that Greece is Argentina. There are obviously significant differences between the two countries. And one cannot say with a high level of confidence that Greece will have a similar experience. But the alternative being presented to Greece at this moment is one of endless grinding depression, with the youth of the country, in whom the country, the government has invested significantly in the education system, fleeing en masse. The country has no future at this stage. At least with a drachma or some other sovereign currency, it will have a greater degree of control over its destiny than it currently has and can possibly have within the Eurozone.
Dimitri, I thank you so much for joining us, and we look forward to your ongoing updates. Have a good evening.
You too, Sharmini.
And thank you for joining us on the Real News Network.
With the emergence of capitalism, class power and privilege also were justified as manifestations of human nature. People are selfish. Some are go-getters, others are laggards. The system rewards and encourages the creative and the inventive and punishes the slothful and parasitic. But if it's so natural and it's so inevitable, why were the laws rewritten during the 19th century to protect and to arm the privileges of finance capital and industrial capital? I mean, if it was a natural thing that would just play itself out in the free market, why did you need the state? Why did you need to set up eminent domain laws, which were used to wipe out small property owners to the advantage of canal and railroad speculators? Or, as is done today, eminent domain still used to wipe out small property owners to make way for big developers and corporate investors who build their office buildings and shopping malls. Why were labor laws written to deprive workers of any means of self-protection? If it was all natural, everybody in their place, just as Plato said, the carpenter doing his carpentry, why did you need a law that made it a crime for the carpenter to talk to another carpenter and join together to try to better their lives? Why were gun thugs needed and sheriffs and Pinkerton detectives and company goons and state militia and the U.S. Army used to keep people down? These people who were naturally in their place in this natural system that's part of the natural outgrowth, the ordinary diurnal activity of human nature every day. This civilization built on the gun and the sword and the rope and the whip, this is all perfectly natural, unforced, uncoerced. If it was so uncoerced, why is it a history of the most artificial coercive powers of the state, used repeatedly to give the wealthy every advantage and every predominance, as it's still being used to this day, right now, as we sit here and talk? If it's so natural, then why do they need death squads in El Salvador? If it's so natural to defend that imperialism and defend that natural system of capitalism, then why are people risking their lives against it in many parts of the world? Why use every subterfuge to keep the mass of people down, keep them divided, keep them disfranchised, if they're such laggards and if they're so uninterested in self-betterment? No, they're supposed to be interested in self-betterment. They're supposed to be interested in individual, selfish betterment. I want to better myself. I want to get ahead. Get ahead of what? Get ahead of the others. It's when they do collective self-betterment. It's when they begin to see that their self-interest is an interest of a whole social formation. That's when it becomes unnatural. And that's when we've got to go in there on them.
Checks. They sold us to shit, now we're sick to death. It's a slow-mo bomb, don't hit the deck. The folks don't know how to pose a threat. Sitting still like the pose in the sofa set. Got the kids on meds and moms off the breast. Dress cracks in the crust, they pass the buck. The corrupt from the past to the future truck. The hugest chunks of poop, fruits, and junk. Pump that shit for the mass consumption. Production, taking a massive dump. Then the whole world's flat from capital lust. And trust that they fuck with the stats and stuff. They lie from the side to the back to front. I said, holy shit, just how big are we supposed to get? Yet, growth protect the gross and the net. Just how big are we supposed to get? Yet, I said, holy shit, and just how big are we supposed to get? Growth protect the gross and the net, and yet, yeah. You need to grow for the rest to waste. It's so fast, no chance if you slow the pace. There's no way, say masters of market fate. Backslide might cause the collapse as they pass the blade. They're ticking like the Catholic faith, cap and trade. You know the growth gon' get paid. And how long do we gon' reach the face of when each man faced with the same starvation? And ignorance ain't bliss, it's complacence. Work on this shit, grins on our faces. Every last drop rot from nations. Boys under work and stand an ovation for it. I said, holy shit, just how big are we supposed to get? Yet, growth protect the gross and the net. Just how big are we supposed to get? Yet, I said, holy shit, and just how big are we supposed to get? Growth protect the gross and the net. And yet, yeah. They need the growth to protect their asses. Cause the lack of the growth and the market crashes. Splash, the text and the news they flash. The masses are stressed by a mass collapse. Yeah, they measure growth in the trees they slash. The hills that they blast from mining shafts. And like the bombs dropped on Iraq, they got contracts for jets, boats, and gats. And they measure growth in the oldest math. They add, and they don't subtract. No tax when they take and they rape and slash. They raking all the coals with the souls they got, yeah. Growth poses pro bowler cap. Throws its weight all over the map. And a lot of profit from aftermath. They got them counting the stacks off our collapse, yeah. I said, holy shit, and just how big are we supposed to get? Yet, growth protect the gross and the net. Just how big are we supposed to get? Yet, I said, holy shit, and just how big are we supposed to get? Growth protect the gross and the net, and yet we're living too large. I said, we're living too large. I think we're living too large. I said, we're living too large. Lord, Lord.
You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That, of course, was Michael Parenti concerning the propaganda that the capitalist class puts out about human nature, what is quote-unquote called human nature, and trying to use it to justify the exploitative situation that people, like working people, live under in this world today. You know, and of course, you see this in the mainstream media all the time, you know, that kind of message. And I've talked about that on the show many times. And of course, after that, we had Lee Reed with his song, The Growth, which of course just talks about capitalism and really about capitalist accumulation and how the entire system is based on just more and more and more and just more exploitation, more accumulation, more profits at the expense of people. That's really what capitalism is based on. So, and of course, that's really what the basis of the crisis in Greece is right now. You know, of course, the bankers really wanting it all. They know that they have a lot. They can get more. They want it all. That's the mantra of the capitalist class and the capitalist system right there, in a nutshell. And that originally came from Michael Parenti as well. That was a quote actually directly from him. You know, and Dimitri Lascara certainly understands this. I mean, it kind of comes out like throughout that entire talk which he just gave. You know, really the nature of the capitalist system and why Greece is being victimized like this right now. And certainly it isn't them. I mean, obviously, it isn't just them. You know, obviously, last week I talked about some other situations in the world, whether that's Puerto Rico, whether that's India, or whether that's, you know, Mexico, or all these other countries which are victims of imperialism and victims of capitalism, and how those two things go hand in hand in the exploitation of working people around the world. So, and of course, just this week, I mean, I saw how that plays out here in Guelph, because, you know, you see the kind of control that a company like Linamar exerts over the city and how it controls, you know, not only itself, but other companies such as Skyjack and other kind of companies within the city, and the kind of power that it exerts on local politics and provincial politics, for that matter. And obviously it gets, like, tax-free grants and things like that from the provincial government. You know, it employs and exploits immigrant labor. You know, it's cut down big time on workers' wages in the past 10 years. You know, people working there, in many cases, cannot make ends meet or, like, survive in anything more than just, like, you know, the most bare-bones accommodations imaginable, basically, in particular in the Willow Road area of the city. You know, there are people living in poverty there. There's families living in poverty, and these are the kind of people who came out to the 15 in Fairness, you know, the campaign to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour. A public meeting which took place at Sheldale Community Center just this past Wednesday. And I was at that meeting, hearing the stories that people had. You know, they were, many of these people were working in factories, or they were working in restaurants, in the service industry, or what have you. And these people were not unionized. They didn't have protection. They didn't have any of this sort of stuff that, people had in the past in this country. You know, they have to work for, you know, less than $15 an hour. They have to work for, you know, say, you know, 12, 13 bucks or something like that an hour, and they don't get adequate hours in some cases. And, you know, it's very, very difficult for them to even make ends meet, to pay the rent. To, you know, rents are pretty high in this city, as needless to say, a lot of the listeners probably know. And just all the different factors which kind of go into sustaining a person or a family in a situation like this. You have to take care of all the necessities of life, you know, and especially, that's especially taxing if you have a family to support. And try doing that, even supporting one person on, say, 13 bucks an hour with, like, the cost of rent and food and all that stuff is, like, you know, a very, very difficult thing to do. Imagine if you got like dependents who you have to support, like, you know, a couple of kids or something. It's very, very difficult. And this is the struggle that people around the world have to face, you know, in all sorts of conditions. But, you know, this struggle, but it's hard. It doesn't matter where you are. It is hard. And you have to make sacrifices. You know, you have to go, you catch hell. You have to go through all kinds of nonsense just to make it, just to survive. Keep your head above water. You know, and we need to stop this whole, like, comparison game that we engage in. You know, comparing people suffering around the world and, like, you know, basically saying, oh, yeah, you don't, and basically writing off people, like, say, in working people in Canada as basically saying, oh, yeah, you aren't really suffering. Because people really are. People do have it hard. And we need to build solidarity between people's struggles, not try to divide them. Which, of course, is what the, you know, because, of course, the ruling class, the capitalist class, thrives upon division. It wants to turn workers against each other. And this is not something we should be facilitating when we engage in activism, when we try to mobilize people, when we try to fight for these kind of causes, you know, whether that's raising the minimum wage or what have you. You know, we need to bring people together. We need to organize together. We need to bring migrant workers into things. We need to bring Aboriginal communities into things. We need to, you know, build alliances across borders, unify with workers' struggles in other countries. You know, this is what really needs to be done. So I think really to kind of close out the show, I'm going to play, once again, I know I played this last week, but I want to play it again, is the interview which I did with Michael Parenti, where, of course, he was talking about austerity, the kind of regime which the capitalist class imposes on the world, where, of course, it forces workers to work harder and harder for less and less while maximizing profits for itself. You know, this is the situation that people around the world are facing now. And this is the situation we need to unite in the context of and fight back. You know, this is crucial. So I'm going to leave you with this, brothers and sisters, and I'm going to see you all next week. So solidarity with all of you, and I will see you all next time. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR. Okay, hello everyone. You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. We are speaking to Dr. Michael Parenti, progressive author and scholar based in Berkeley, California. And we're going to talk to him about his recent book, which I believe just came out in April of this year. It's called Profit Pathology and Other Indecencies. And you can read more of Michael's stuff at michaelparenti.org. And I'll mention that again later on. So hello, Michael. How's it going?
Hello, how are you, Siegfried?
Pretty good. It's been a while since we last talked, so I'm glad we got this opportunity to do so, especially in light of, well, I mean, just everything that's been going on in the world now and, like, the appropriate timing, I think, of this this book you've just put out. So,
thank you.
Yeah, if we maybe could just kind of launch right into things. My first question is basically if you could just outline what is austerity.
Well, austerity is imposing upon the working people scarcity and hardship, and that's done by those at the top who work us,
mm-hmm.
and who have all sorts of political rallies where they talk about the loafers and the lazy people and who don't want to work and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So they blame, and the poor are always blamed for their own poverty. They are seen as the authors of their own poverty, when in fact that's not true. And the truth is that wealth creates poverty. In many instances, poverty is the creation by wealth. I mean, slaves wasn't their laziness. They put in 18-hour days of toil of all kinds, and the plantation owners. Wealth and luxury and accumulation was from the exploitation of the poor. So that's how you get wealth. A few people will expropriate the land and labor and resources of everybody else. Anyway, that's that's one of the points one has to make. Mm-hmm. What was it you were asking again?
Well, this is what is austerity, basically, right? Like, of course, we're hearing this term like all the time these days, like about austerity, the need for austerity. It's like the language, the chosen language, you could say, of the elite, which is kind of imposing this. And you see in Europe, we see in North America, we see like really all over the world now since the recession.
They don't want to say homelessness and hunger and no access to medical care.
Right.
You know, they call it austerity. You know, like learn to curb and don't be a freeloader and all that. When in fact, it's the rich. It's that 1% or one fraction of 1% at the top that is really the freeloader. Nobody goes to the government for more handouts than the very, very super rich. They they have enormous amounts of policies and programs for their own benefit. If I don't lose my voice here, I think you got my point.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I mean, it's and it almost seems like austerity is almost like a feature of the capitalist system in general. It's just the word maybe has kind of come into vogue, but I mean, they've been doing this for a long time, right?
Yeah, they most certainly have been doing it for a long time. Yes, that's correct. Yes. And whenever there was a set of circumstances at World War II that changed things around a bit. We came out of a deep depression that had lasted about 15 years. I mean, the New Deal did a lot of good things, but, you know, it never really got the U.S. out of its depression. And then came the war.
Mm-hmm.
The war was actually a lot of good-paying jobs for people. The ruling class spent amounts of money to kill people and destroy towns and cities, an amount that it would not spend in peacetime to get people out of the depression. But that war got people out of the depression. 9 million American men, mostly men, almost all men, came back from the war, and there was a GI Bill that was passed for them. And that was a remarkable thing, because unlike the GI Bill today, where where veterans have to also get a job on the side or take out student loans or whatever else, the GI Bill does not help them the way it promised to really do. But in those days, it did, and it also gave money for small businesses to start and all that. So there was a tremendous burst of prosperity, of spending. there was a pileup of money that people had from 4 years of working in the defense plants where they couldn't spend that money because all those factories were not making refrigerators and stoves and cars. They were making bombs and planes and tanks and things of that sort. So this combination of things, plus there was not a stripping down. There was a big stripping down of the military, of course, but a substantial military was kept going 1946-47 because of the Cold War was starting. The Red Army was on the Elbe. The big communist parties in France and Italy. The workers in Western Europe were developing social democracies. They were getting free medical care. They were getting job programs, free education. These things that they were doing that because people in Eastern Europe were getting the same kinds of things, and it was a sort of a historic compromise. Which we had to, you know, keep up with the Reds. And here, you know, here in the communist countries, people spent only one tenth of their salary for rent. They had free medical care. They had free education up to the highest level of their abilities. They had very subsidized and improved transportation, and all these kind of things were happening. So the West had to do some of the same things, and it was what were being built then in those days was you had a well-being that had never existed quite like that before in the West, and that's when the mythology also emerged that every gen, America's the land of prosperity, and for whatever prosperity, they really advertised it and ideologized it, if I can create a word. It was part of the ideology that only in America everybody's got a car now, and the whole transportation infrastructure was built with government money, people's public money, to subsidize the automotive industry, and these superhighways were built and all of that at public expense for the trucking industry and the automotive industry's benefit. And this went on and on, and then when you got to the late 70s, early 80s, they started turning it all around. Reagan came in, and there was the feeling was, enough is enough, we've got to roll this back. And they've done a terrific job of doing just that thing. And so you now have that great, prosperous middle class that we always heard about and all that, now much pitied and much rolled back and going broke in many instances.
Yeah. So of course we see this kind of momentary historical compromise that now is being clawed back, and I guess austerity is the latest incarnation, at least of the language of that rollback.
Right. Austerity and impoverishment and oppression, those were the normal conditions of capitalism in the United States all through the 1800s and the early 1900s, and right up until the late part of the 20th century. 80s or so is a turnaround, and you get more and more of it today. Today, mm-hmm. you have students graduating college with $75,000 debts. You know, you have the same rollback going on, of course, now in Eastern Europe.
Mm-hmm, that's true.
They don't owe the working class anything anymore. They just started rolling them back, Richard Pipes, of all people, I mean, a conservative like him, I'll give him credit. He didn't suppress the study, but he did the study of all the former communist countries. You know how things are, and it came out overwhelmingly. People saying it was better under communism.
Mm-hmm.
Better under communism. You know, the farmers would say it was better. We got subsidies. We could sell our stuff and this and that and. And students, it was better for them. It was better for public transportation. Was better. The healthcare system was more equitable, more accessible, and you can go on. So that's what they're really. The whole game is really a class struggle game. That's what it is.
Yeah. If I could go back to something you mentioned very briefly before, was just how. War is now being like tied in with austerity. You see, like, you know, with austerity now, you see increased rise of interventions of like basically the American military and Western military forces abroad, and increased violence around the world, and increased interventions and these kind of things. So, how does that really imperialism tie in with austerity?
Well, imperialism. The empire feeds off the republic. I mean, where does an empire get its operational wealth from? From the republic, from the mm-hmm. people. You got to tax the American public. How do you get to tax them, and so that you have a federal budget every year in which 52% is for military purposes? Right there, that's just 52% off the top. And not to mention a lot of other things, military pensions, all sorts of other stuff. But so the way you do that is you convince your public that this is for their safety. We have to control the world, or the world will devour us. And so we've been seeing it again and again and again. Imperialism is an extension, an outgrow of capitalism. But it's also a way of making the world safe for the plutocracy. That's really its great goal, and to provide places for investment and further profit at greater margins than before.
Yeah, and I guess this kind of goes into the whole profit pathology, right? Because, I mean, I think you even said in one of your talks, you know, the whole idea that capitalism can never stay home. Like, it has to keep expanding. And yes. If it doesn't expand, I mean, basically it collapses, right? So, I mean, like imperialism and capitalism, I guess, go hand in hand with regard to that.
It's a mad system. That's mm-hmm. why I said pathology. I mean, yeah, it is a mad system. It's designed to pay workers as little as possible and yet hope that there'll be many workers with lots of spending power to pick up all these commodities and services that I'm creating with these underpaid workers, you know. And my hope is that some other owner will give their workers enough money so that they'll have the money to buy up the goods and services that my underpaid workers are creating. But the other owners have the same idea, and they, too, underpay their workers. And so there's a chronic overproduction. There's a chronic underconsumption. Even though we have a big consumer society, there's all sorts of crap that you got more things, you know, consumer items and gizmos. And even in the area of food, where the food is, some of the fast food stuff is uneatable, but there it is, and expensive and cheap in some cases. But so imperialism is the outgrowth of capitalism. War brings a false prosperity, you know. Mm-hmm. And socialism, what imperialism is socialism coming to the rescue again. Capitalism is always rescued by the government. I mean, the number of programs of research and development in all sorts of areas, the railroad industry, the mining industry, the steel industry, the airline industry, the internet industry, all these things are publicly owned. That plutocratic class that constantly denounces the government, constantly scolds the American people, as you're saying, austerity. Stop looking for a handout from the government. Stop running off to the government with silly, wasteful things like Social Security and Medicare.
Mm-hmm.
And all. If I didn't have those, I'd be out on the street right now myself. I'm telling. No, it's not funny.
So, well, I mean, there's a lot of people, right? Like, who face that.
Yeah, yeah. And as I said before, the irony is, of course, that same plutocracy goes to the government, I mean, owns the government, I mean, gets more subsidies, agribusiness, trillions of dollars in subsidies, pharmaceuticals, trillions, the medicine industry, and now with Obamacare, you've got the health insurance industry piping up their racket. It's gotten more, it's given people more services, but it has been but these guys get their shakedown before we ever see any services.
Yeah, and I guess this is the real face of the capitalist state, right? The state serving the capitalist class, like these, you know, the Fortune 500. I guess you could say serving their interests and not the interests of the people.
That's correct. Yeah. It ends up serving their interests. They'll take any good program or need that's needed. They'll argue against it. They'll denounce it. But then they'll put through a version of it where they end up walking away with enormous profits.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think you have to engage in a big ideological struggle against the capitalists or imperialists, at least with people when trying to convince them. What I did in this book, Profit Pathology, is I suggested a very simple empirical approach to, rather than an ideological struggle of grand isms, you know, my superism against your superism or whatever, and just do empirical choices. Just look at things. I say, let's have socialism wherever socialism works better than capitalism. Well, we've been taught that socialism's a flop and it doesn't work, and that's that. But, you know, public utilities work much better than private utilities. The rates are cheaper. The services $2-4 million a year as CEO of the utility. You don't have all the kickbacks and whatever else. Mm-hmm. We have a private utility here in California, PG&E, which brought death to users in San Bruno, where people in San Bruno were smelling gas and complaining and saying there's a gas leak somewhere here, and the company didn't. The company is too busy scooping up profits for itself, and it blew up, and 8 people were killed, and another 35 were seriously hurt, and about 40 or 50 houses. If you had seen the photos, I don't know if you ever got them there. They were staggering. These houses were just blown right off their foundations, just nothing there, torn apart like a tornado or something. So public utilities are better. The rates are lower. Your surplus doesn't go to stockholders to enrich them. Your surplus goes into the public budget, and that helps the taxpayers a little, you know. Let's look at schools. Public schools, public universities are better than private ones. The idea that we now have more and more private for-profit universities, for-profit. The school admits that it creates this university to make profits for its shareholders, not for education. Well, again, it would be a lot cheaper if you just have a public university, that you don't have to be producing large amounts of wealth for the shareholders. All the money goes back into the school. How about public medicine, public health care, public hospitals? Mm-hmm. They're better. And the things that public transportation is so much more efficient, so much better for the environment and the like. Our public transportation here carts more people than that congestion and slaughter of cars does. So what do we do for capitalism? Maybe restaurants restaurants. We can say it's better that the restaurant is owned by mom and pop, and they really have the little touch to it, than having the state. Judging from my experience with restaurants in socialist countries, I might lean in that direction. So what I'm saying is, instead of getting into an isms fight, let's just go social function by social function and say, well, what's been better? What's been better? Tell us, really.
Yeah, like just kind of bring it down to like that empirical level, right? I mean, I have a similar story, actually. I mean, you were telling the story about what happened in California where, like, you know, those houses were blown away.
Yeah.
Once again, there's a result of that private company, and the cutbacks and all this kind of stuff. A similar thing happened in Ontario in the 1990s. In this case, it had to do with the privatization of water systems. And,
yeah.
This is something that definitely should be in the public domain, needless
yeah.
to say.
Now, if there's an accident with a public system,
yeah, this
and
was
there's never an end to it, and you say, you see, these systems don't, it's not good, it doesn't work, and you should give it to a private company
yeah.
that's more, and they immediately elevate it into an ism thing, you know, and so
yeah.
forth. But it's not true when it happens to them, when you got the BP blowing up oil floats and destroying half of New Orleans and all that, they just say, oh, that was an accident.
Yeah,
they don't raise the question of, is this the way capitalism operates? Well, this
right.
is terrible. This is life-threatening. This is destroying our environment and our city and our people. They don't say that. They just say, oh, well, there's been an accident. We got to clean it up. Oh.
Mm-hmm.
And then the cleanup goes to socialism also, and they have to pay for it.
Mm-hmm. Like the public has to pay the cost every time, right? I mean, in the Ontario case, it was a town called Walkerton.
Yes.
And basically this place, they had privatized the water system. And because
it was
of the
a private one, you said, did yeah, you say, Siegfried, I didn't hear you.
Yeah, they privatized the water system there.
Oh.
And basically what ended up happening is it got contaminated by E. coli lack of oversight and this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
About like 8 people ended up dead, like hundreds more got sick, and most of the people who died were kids, right?
Oh my God.
So like this kind of thing like happened. It was a big scandal back in like 1995. Like
did
this
they,
happened,
did they
right?
put it under public ownership again, or it's still privately owned?
Well, I mean, these days it's like kind of more of like a public-private kind of partnership or whatever it is they call it. I mean, basically it's like maybe some increased oversight, but it's mostly like in the private domain still. And there's like a lot of privatization going on now. I know the hydro system's about to get privatized and sold off right up here. It's a big big thing. I mean, some people are being mobilized around it right now. Because that was the next thing I was actually going to ask you about. Like, how are people fighting back against against these kind of policies, which are very, very anti-worker, anti-public in general?
Well, they get angry about certain things. You know, PG&E, the company I was telling you about, they were given $42 million. Again, socialism supporting capitalism. Gave them money to rebuild all various pipelines that had problems, were brittle, leaking, or chipping, or showing signs of being being ready to blow up or something. Mm-hmm. They did all that, but it didn't really, you know, it wasn't used. It wasn't used for those purposes. PG&E took that money and waged a campaign, a statewide referendum, to prohibit any kind of public utilities in the state of California. They spent millions. They spent millions of dollars on this campaign, and miracle of miracles, they lost anyway. The people did not want to hand over all the utilities to the private profiteers. And well, I deal with these things in my book. Some of those things, and I also talk about in my book Private Pathology and Other Indecencies. I also talk about how small little things, or you talk about austerity. How about Holocaust? How about extermination? 12 to 18 million native indigenous peoples in North America, and 500 language groups were all destroyed from what, 1600 to 1890, almost three centuries.
Mm-hmm.
Just destruction, to take an immense fortune from them, an immense fortune of mineral deposits, of waters, of forests, lands, topsoil. I mean, a huge enriched continent taken over, stolen, and killing the people, exterminating the people who are on the land, you know. And that's another thing. And then the immense capital accumulation from slavery, which people don't usually talk about, but you know, cotton was probably the greatest value production of any. I mean, more than coal, more than iron, more than just about anything else for quite a while. It was, and again, that was on the labor of African slaves, people who were brought in here and enslaved in terrible ways. This is the so-called primitive accumulation, mm-hmm. indeed primitive, I would say, murderously primitive. And I guess the story I'm saying is, the system is an amazing system of horrors and abuses and murder and destruction and
mm-hmm.
holocausts, and it's all sort of normal. The crises of capitalism, just about every few years, there's a crisis, there's a panic, there's a drop, there's recessions, and it's still going on to this very day. There's still a recession going on right now.
Mm-hmm. And so would you say, like, people are increasingly waking up to the reality of the system here?
I don't know. There certainly are many who are just as stupid and blind to it and bought into it as ever. They watch Fox News and they get roped in. But there are people who are seeing. Look at the protests of the Occupy movement. That was very unusual for the U.S. anyway. Probably better in Canada. I think ideologically somewhat more developed in Canada than they are in the United States. Although there could be plenty of work done there too, and even in Europe, I think the Europeans were so far ahead and sophisticated. The more I spoke in Europe and went, I realized, my gosh, they got some of the wool has been pulled over their eyes too in some instances, you know. It's just got a lot. There's just an awful. You know where the wake up was with the Occupy movement? It was just that one little phrase, 1% versus 99%.
Right.
So suddenly the great divide that you and I and others have been trying to get across and say, look, there's a great divide here, financially, ideologically, anyway. And then developing it a little more, and you say, wait, it's not 1%. 1% of the American population is 3 million people. No, they're not super rich. You can be up there in the top 3 million with $200,000 a year, and you're up in that bracket almost. This is like a fraction of 1%. You know, it's a hundredth of 1%. That the super rich have never been more unequal among themselves than they are today. And in other words, in America, in any case, we still don't even realize, we don't know how rich the super rich really are. Look at these homes up on the hill here in Berkeley, and they go for $2 million, and they're very nice homes indeed. I would never be able to afford such a place, but that's not rich, you know. That could be a professor with tenure and some smart investments could probably float a house like that or something. The very rich are people who live in places where you don't see their front yards that easily, you know, because there's a gate and there's a great estate and there's a special pad for a helicopter or a private plane, and they live really very different.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, there certainly has been people waking up, though. I mean, like, I've been quite impressed by the campaigns for raising the minimum wage, which are, like, in a lot of U.S. cities now, and a lot of, like, low-wage workers, like, from McDonald's even, like, who, you know, most people wouldn't even see them going out on strike, but they're going out on strike. And there's, like, been quite a few actions. Like, it seems like a lot of places. And even in Ontario now, like, we're starting to see, you know, raise the minimum wage to $15. Like, that's becoming a pretty big thing now.
Yes, and as I say, it gets back to that madness and that contradiction of not paying the people who you need as customers. You know?
It's true, you know. And well, I mean, another thing, of course, like Indigenous peoples. I mean, we talked about that before, all the things that they've suffered at the hands of, like, you know, they say primitive accumulation, and they're increasingly politically active. You know, like they, you might have even seen the picture from this when I was in Washington D.C. A few months ago, right? And, like, you know, they raised the Mohawk flag outside the White House, and these were people who were coming down in support of Ecuadorian activists who were campaigning against Chevron, you know, what it's done to the Ecuadorian rainforest.
Yeah.
You know, and the devastation that it's caused down there, right? So, I mean, you see these – I mean, that was some very real international solidarity there, and you also had, like, the Indigenous dynamic in there as well, and it was very amazing to be a part of that.
Sometimes it does reach a point where the oppression can be so extreme that the people who are oppressed have no choice but to fight back. And I mean, when you think of it, who the hell can live on $7 an hour? I mean,
it's true.
At least in this country, the way prices are, the prices are still going up. You know,
mm-hmm.
Gas went down, big deal. Well, that's something, but it's really a shame. It's a shame. It's an insult. It's an offense to people's humanity. It is. So that's what the book is about. I wrote a lot of stuff in there, and it's only 150 pages. But I sort of had fun packing it in. I shouldn't say have fun. Sometimes it was with a painful grimace, but that's the way it goes.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is some pretty serious serious stuff we're talking about here, right?
Yes, indeed.
This book, once again, like, sounds very interesting. I know I'm going to try to read it as soon as I can. And this is Profit Pathology and Other Indecencies, which I think you who publishes that?
It's Rutledge and Paradigm Publishers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right. And once again, like, your website is michaelparenti.org.
That's correct.
And so if people want to, like, read more of your articles or find out about more of your books. Mm-hmm. You know, just they can go and check that out. Well,
yes, thank you.
Mm-hmm. And I guess probably what we should end on is Antonio Gramsci's quote. You know, just of all we've talked about, you know, we must have a pessimism of the mind, but an optimism of the will.
Right.
Right. I know you've said that many times, and I know I've certainly tried to take that one to heart. You know, given what we're up against, but what these struggles that we have to basically face, what we have to go through.
Mm-hmm.
It's very important. All right, so Michael Parenti, thank you very much for joining us today on Back in the USSR. I really appreciate this.
Thank you, Siegfried. Thank you.
Okay, I'll talk to you soon, all right?
Right, sure.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Deux grandes traditions qui malheureusement ont marqué trop d'années de l'histoire de la province de Québec. Premièrement, le mépris le plus complet pour l'intelligence du citoyen qu'on considère comme une simple marchandise électorale. Et deuxièmement, la servilité d'un parti de rois nègres qui sont en fait les valets de chambre de certains gros intérêts, surtout les plus rapaces, qui eux aussi méprisent la population comme une espèce de tribu arriérée qui est faite pour être exploitée à loisir.
Au tour maintenant du chef du Parti libéral du Québec, M. Jean Charest.
Merci, mon pète. Je suis prêt. L'équipe libérale est prête. Nous sommes prêts.
Prêt, prêt, la charrue, charrée, acharnée, charrue. En charpie, la charpente de la maison qu'on a mis 40 ans à bâtir.
Un spot que milité pour Amir Kadir. Maintenant la table est mise pour 4 ans à partir. À parler à vue d'œil, à Uri à la vue. De la bande abrutée qui brade à bride abattue. Qui vend à rabais par la bande. Ce qui a pas de prix, une bonne mande. De finir de payer sans d'un abatti. Coupe sombre, coupe à blanc, coupe gris.
Alouette, je t'ai plus marré.
Et puis pour couper coro, coro populaire. Bah t'as profité ouf, la foule est légifère. À tombeau ouvert, puis tout sourire, ça la soupe populaire.
C'est ça être solidaire quand on a sacré tout à terre.
Afin de faire taire, un argumentaire, un écantaire d'Amérique fait son affaire. Ça fait bien trop l'affaire, des régents d'affaires. Du Canada, puis du conseil du patronat.
Baillon, bon baillon, je raille pareil, le patron des patrons.
Ta gueule, taillon.
C'est le démantèlement, tellement texte, tellement que c'est comme de la musique à tes oreilles. Comment t'aimes le tête à mort des barbares? Dans tes tympans d'avoir un gars.
Face à la menace de la patrie, on brandit le poing de la patrie à la face des bandits. Face à la menace de la patrie, on brandit le poing.
Libérez-nous des libéraux.
Libérez-nous des libéraux. Libérez-nous des libéraux. Libérez-nous des libéraux. Libérez-nous des libéraux. Libérez-nous des libéraux. Libérez-nous des libéraux.
J'te dis carré, catégorique, j'en charrais.
Mike Harris,
même combat.
Même charisme, même carnesse. Des biens et services publics en lice. Faut que ça finisse la chasse au PS. Pour eux, c'est une business inespéré. Puis ceux qui dépérissent, il reste plus qu'à prier.
Saint-Jean-Baptiste,
ça prendra ma race
de séparatistes.
Y a pas de place, on peut pas faire la pièce.
Contrat de performance pour la SGF.
Pour les CPE,
pour les SDF.
Hey, un impôt sur la quête.
T'sais, ce serait pas bête.
Ça dirige le Québec comme une PME.
Comme un PIM, c'est put pour qu'elle aligne les pays.
PES, ça c'est, ça se connaît. La clé du succès pour le 24 succès, c'est d'asexuer le Québec.
Quel beau sujet pour Jean-Claude Labrec. À hauteur de gnome,
hauteur de braguette.
Sucer debout, c'est ça, se tenir drette.
Je suis prêt.
On est loin de maître chez nous. Maintenant comme jamais, y'a un traître chez nous.
Ça s'entend quand il parle comme un derrière de boîte de céréales.
Si tu penses me faire taire, tu fais à ton âge d'intarissable. Je vais sous ton ciel, musée, je suis ton féal.
Face à la menace de la braderie, on brandit le poing de la patrie à la face des bandits.
Face à la menace de la braderie, on brandit le poing.
Libérez-nous des libéraux.
Libérez-nous des libéraux.
Libéral, fédéral, ça bringue dingo. Viva Canada, banana republica.
Banda sur manda, on est d'accord là.
Un parti unique, c'est un parti inique, cynique, inique. Tout débat démocratique, la confiance de la rue est rompue. Car la cour de l'empereur corrompu accumule les écus. Et enfin, quand il s'en a fait, le monarque débarque. Mais passe le pouvoir à son homme de main. Comme un bon roi
chrétien.
Mais selon moi,
Martin
tient du requin. Que du dauphin, l'armateur, arnaqueur, anglo, franco, c'est plus trop, joue sur tous les tableaux. C'est l'homme des chalons, mais des salam alec.
Mais comment croyez-vous qu'ils conçoivent le Québec?
Depuis 10 ans, véritable sous-marin, soi-disant nous dans la même émate, nous dématé en parquant le gros paquebot des fédéraux dans nos eaux. C'est sûr, il s'assénue comme la moelle dans nos eaux. En somme, ça me semble simple sous les libéraux. Québec et Ottawa sont les lames de ciseaux. L'une décrisse les racines du lycée, l'autre timide sur sein de nos services.
Ça fait que masculer, puis enculer, le calculer, pas compliqué, on va reculer.
Devant tant d'unifoliés déployés à tous les paliers, croyez qu'on va tous se noyer, croyez dans
Paul Martin, président directeur général du Canada. Je suis heureux de constater que les cocos cocasses s'intéressent au Parti libéral. Et du libéral, et du libéral.